I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. For almost 3 years, NATO nations have been arming a genocide in Palestine after more than a century of ethnic cleansing ahead of Zionism's final solution for Arab Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. International revolutionaries have long identified Palestine as a litmus test for the struggle for global justice. And 61 years ago this month, Malcolm X visited Gaza and proclaimed that the Palestinian struggle is not just a crime for justice, it's a blistering battle for the most fundamental human rights. This year is the 60th anniversary of the FBI-CIA New York police-linked assassination of Malcolm X. His life trajectory was one that inspired hundreds of millions across the global south, as well as the wretched of the neoliberal world. By the end, he was calling out what Going Underground calls out all the time. Malcolm X warned of media power, that the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing. In Birmingham, in the UK, where Malcolm visited before his killing, is a scholar and lifelong champion of Malcolm X. Professor Kehinde Andrews is the author of the new book, Nobody Can Give You Freedom, The Political Life of Malcolm X. He's the founder of the Harambee Organization of Black Unity and Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University. Professor Andrews, thank you so much for coming back on the show after so long. You know, it was a year before his assassination, 5 years before after Che Guevara, that Malcolm X went to Gaza, copying down into his diary a poem read to him by the Palestinian poet Harun Hashem Rashid about a Khan Yunis massacre that had been happening for the past 2 years every other day. Before we get to your book, what do you think he'd have said about the British-American EU arming of a genocide?
Well, thanks for having me back on the show. And it obviously, talking about genocide, never a cheery topic. But Malcolm was somebody who would have understood it very clearly. As you said, he visited Palestine. He felt very deeply. Malcolm was a devout Muslim and spent the last part of his life in the Arab world, as well as traveling through Africa. And what he saw in Palestine was, it's Malcolm would explain this as the inevitable thing of white supremacy, right? You have a place where white settler violence. We've seen it play out throughout the world. What is white settler violence in South America, in North America, in Africa, in Asia? This is the logic of white supremacy. So Malcolm would have clearly been on the side of the Palestinian people and understood that this genocide we're seeing is the inevitable function of white supremacy, of settler colonialism, unfortunately.
You know, over the years, I've kind of warmed to Martin Luther King Jr., I have to say. His daughter was on this show a while back. But there was a big argument I had, I remember, in the early days of this show. Colette Valentine, the editor-in-chief of this show, was speaking up for Martin Luther King Jr., and I was saying, what are you talking about? Malcolm X is the man. And I'm sure it's an argument that's been going on for years. Yeah. She told me to listen to the Vietnam speech, and I kind of changed my mind to a big degree. And then I'm reading your new book, and I think I might be changing my mind again. Outline the key differences between MLK Jr. I mean, there's a national holiday created by Ronald Reagan in the United States for him. There isn't one for Malcolm X. What are the differences between them, the crucial differences that we must never forget between them?
Yeah, so a big thing with the book is trying to dispel the myths. And one of the myths is that the difference between Malcolm and Martin is violence and nonviolence. So, you know, Malcolm's supposed to be the one who wants to rain terror on America and the world, but this is clearly nonsensical. Malcolm never committed any political violence and has committed the same amount of political violence as King, zero. The difference between them is that Malcolm is a revolutionary and says that actually, look, if we see what America supports, and actually Israel, Palestine is a perfect example. If we see the genocide that America is supporting in Gaza, that isn't an example of America not doing what it's supposed to do. And King will be saying, well, look, let America live up to its true ideals and be fair to the Palestinian people. And Malcolm understands that actually the true ideals of America are settler colonial genocide. That's what America is, right? So once you understand that the system is inherently violent, inherently racist, then you understand that you can't reform America. You can't fix America. America is the problem. Europe is the problem. And the solution to that problem has to be revolution. And that's where they divide. King had faith in the American project. Malcolm understood that the American project can only ever be a nightmare for black and brown people around the world.
And so even the Vietnam speech doesn't make a difference, because he's talking about the betrayal of the American dream in the city of the hill, where, as your version of Malcolm X says, no, there's something... It's a nation founded on genocide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, King has this hope that he believes the hype of America, that America is this great shining beacon and that America is betraying its values in Vietnam or now in Palestine. That is not the case. The values of America are white supremacy, genocide, and violence. And that is why America keeps sowing white supremacy, genocide, and violence around the world. Malcolm understood the American project far better than King because he knew that at its core, it is white supremacy.
And when it comes to violence, or non-violence, I mean, arguably the Vietnam speech started to make one think even MLK was willing to fight for the North Vietnamese. Who knows? But because clearly the feds were frightened of both of them. Both of them were killed. But describe the importance, centrality of political violence in Malcolm X's ideas as self-defense. And how important it is to remember that violence is part of that by any means necessary, quote, on the T-shirts amongst hundreds of millions of people around the world.
Yeah, so for violence is important in the sense of, in the West, Malcolm was saying, look, self-defense. And actually, interestingly enough, him and Martin Luther King didn't differ too much. The civil rights movement was non-violence in its protests, but when they were in the South at night asleep, they had armed guards. You know, King had slept with a gun under his sofa pillow because they were going to be killed if they didn't, right? So the idea that you defend yourself is one that is, I think, widely held, even in the civil rights movement. The big difference you'll see with political violence is on the world stage, is where Malcolm's actually, you know, you do need revolutionary violence because you are dealing with the most violent system that has ever existed. Western capitalism, imperialism, Europe, whatever you want to call it, has killed more people than any other political economic system in the history of the planet. And so if you're going to have freedom in Africa, if you're going to have freedom in Asia, if you're going to have freedom in Palestine, guess what? You're probably going to need to actually use some political violence. And so, again, thinking about Israel-Palestine, Malcolm certainly will be on the side of saying, look, you have to pick up arms if you are going to fight back against a vicious settler colonial regime. And that is an area where King was a pacifist because King believed, again, that you could solve this by appealing to the fairness of the devil. And Malcolm understood that was not a sane proposition if you wanted to have freedom.
Now, I mean, reading the book, which tore apart all these myths about Malcolm X, I'll get on to the myths in the autobiography in a moment. And one of my mentors was Tariq Ali. He's been on the show, the historian, and he spent an evening with Malcolm X when he came to the Oxford Union. I know that you mentioned that you went to the Oxford Union partly because you thought it's okay to go there because Malcolm X once went there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know, maybe Tariq can correct me, but I'm pretty sure Tariq Ali says Malcolm X clearly said he was coming close to Marxism. And that would have been 1964. When was he killed? You'll have to remind me. Your book, very clearly saying, no, this is the dead old white men obsession by lefties talking about Malcolm X. Aren't you stripping him of his power? That's his power, because he was allied to, you know, he said of Che Guevara, whose brother and daughter have been on this show as well, he said Che Guevara was one of the most revolutionary men in the country when Che was in the United States.
Yeah, no, I mean, Malcolm was revolutionary, Marxist, a revolutionary, so he was very pro-Castro, he was pro-Che, he was pro-Marxist in Africa, like, certainly, there's not many revolutionary arguments, and the Marxists have been the ones at the forefront. So Malcolm certainly had a sympathy for Marxism. Where I'm saying is that Malcolm was definitely not a Marxist because Marxism gets it wrong on a very real level. For Malcolm's analysis, racism is at the core, it's at the heart, it's at the foundation. It is the stone on which all class relations are built upon. And what Marxism always gets wrong is that Marxism argues it's the other way around, that race is a production of class. And I don't want to go into all the long, long, long lecture detail about this, but it's just wrong, right? And so Malcolm's political program...
It makes it easier, though, for elites to cope with that identitarian anger over the class one united with the identity one. I mean, why do you say at the same time it's so central, the house Negro, field Negro dichotomy, which seems pretty Marxist kind of definitions?
No. So, for example, actually, house Negro, field Negro is a perfect example of Malcolm's class analysis, where house Negro is those, these people like myself, actually, I'm in a very good position, right? I make more money than most people in the world, mostly because most people in the world don't make that much money. I'm clearly protected from most of the racism. So on the plantation, I would have been in the house, right? And that would put me at odds to those in the field who are catching hell, et cetera, et cetera. And in a standard class analysis, those two positions are quite separate, right? One's close to the oppressor and one's not. What Malcolm's actually saying is, even though I'm in the house, I'm still a slave, or still an ex-slave, or still a colonial subject. And actually, my real isn't my economic position, it's my blackness, which puts me with the people in the field, even though I'm in the house, and says that actually blackness is the thing that transcends all other things, and that's the thing that we should unite around, understanding that there are other struggles, understanding that we support any revolutionary struggle. But the fundamental thing which brings us together is our blackness. And that is not a production of capitalism. That is not some identitarian politics that's made up to divide the classes. That is a real legitimate connection that binds us into a political project together.
And yet one's behavior is completely changed by your economic position so that, I don't know, Spike Lee and Oprah Winfrey, behind the famous Hollywoodized version of Malcolm X, clearly act differently to, you know, the people bombed in Philadelphia.
Well, but then again, for Malcolm's trying, and what Malcolm's trying to do when he's calling as Negroes, and Malcolm would definitely call Oprah and Spike Lee as Negroes. Nothing, there's no doubt about that. But what, in doing that, he'd be calling them in and saying, "Well, look, yes, I'm critical of you," and even actually, there's Malcolm used to absolutely eviscerate black celebrities like Lorraine Hansberry. Ozzie Davis even got the lash sometimes. But behind the scenes, Malcolm was meeting with these people and saying, "Look, I'm criticizing you because you're not on the side of the masses. You still rich, elite, all this money, you're doing the wrong thing, but it just takes a change of mind, a change of frame, understand that you're still black and you should be with the black masses." That's not a standard Marxist class analysis.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say nuanced? Because you really attack it in the new book. It's like, do not say it. And then you single out the fact Karl Marx was white, which I think is a bit harsh.
So in the book, to be honest, I think I was just more dismissive than like really going against Marxism, because I was trying to say, look, what is Malcolm's political philosophy? And it's just not Marxist. So I was laying out the philosophy and saying, well, look, it's not Marxist. And hopefully from reading the book, you can see how it's not Marxist. But that doesn't mean there's not support. I went to a whole Marxist conference the other day, and it was that was an experience, I'll be honest. But there's a lot of solidarity across the borders. But it is understanding that what is the political project. For Malcolm X, it was the unity of black people around the world, in Africa and in the diaspora. That's a political project. And that's the political project that we're trying to start and to carry on with the Rambi Organization of Black Unity. And it's simply not a Marxist project. And I think it's important to understand the differences of that, to say, what are we trying to do and how do we change the world?
So that you can make alliances with different elements. Because it is just so notable that, I mean, you're just saying it just so happened that Malcolm X lived at a time when the revolutionary movements were all left-leaning. But surely that's to do with the fact the Soviet Union was helping to support so many of these movements against U.S. hegemonic power.
Yeah, Soviet Union and China, certainly. Yeah, but I think to go back to this, the ideas matter. And I think Marxist whiteness is something we overlook all the time, right? So there's a great book by Cedric Robinson called Black Marxism. And what black people tend to do is, with Marxism, we try to reclaim Marxism. So Marx gets things wrong on many levels. In fact, Cedric Robinson says it himself. Marx, the problem with Marxism is he identified the white working class as being the hero of history, and then made a theory that the white working class were the hero of history, when actually, where was the revolution? It was the peasantry in the Soviet Union. It was the peasantry in China. It was the peasantry in Africa. It was the peasantry in Latin America. Marx was just wrong, because Marx was a typical dead white male Enlightenment thinker that believed that everything went through Europe. And actually, the reality is that the most oppressed and production is now in the global South. So we just need a new theory that doesn't center around this dead white man.
Professor Kehinde Andrews, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Nobody Can Give You Freedom, The Political Life of Malcolm X, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the author of Nobody Can Give You Freedom, The Political Life of Malcolm X, Professor Kehinde Andrews. Professor Andrews, you say in the book about what Malcolm X might have said right now about U.S. politics. You said that he'd perhaps have more to say about genocide Joe Biden than Donald Trump, because, quote, no sensible person would believe he was anything but a bloody jawed wolf as regards Donald Trump. But voting amongst the African-American community in the United States doubled for Donald Trump. It wasn't just the white working class that I know you were celebrating in part one of this episode. Do you not see that it's the kind of crypto anarchism perceived of Donald Trump that is attracting disenfranchised black voters in the United States and certainly offers something different to continued oppression that's a hallmark of the Democrat Party in the United States?
Well, I think that the vote doubled because it was so low, right? Even with black men, it was, what, 80 plus percent of black men voted.
It went up 8 to 16%, yeah. 8 to 16.
Yeah, so it's still like, it's such a small number that doubled that we can look at it and go, oh, wow, this is, but it's not actually, in raw terms, it's not a massive jump. It is certainly a jump and something certainly happened. But the fact that some black men have been deluded by the maleness, the bravado, the lack of faith, and a lot of this, to be honest, is lack of faith in the Democrats. If we're 100% honest, it wasn't just a black male vote. So many young black people wouldn't vote for genocide Joe Biden because of Gaza, etc., which is fair enough. And in a two-party system, once you run from the fox, you end up going to the wolf. So I think the idea that Trump is popular with black people in America is just not true. Like, there's no evidence for that at all. You take those raw numbers of who vote, it's very, very clear that most black people are very obvious and very clear that Trump's nothing more than a bloody jawed wolf. Although I do accept some people are delusional, but some people are always delusional. And I don't think it's, I think it's been well overstated just how much support he has with black men.
And there being no alternative, seeming alternative. Why do you believe, famously, that the FBI edited the posthumous autobiography of Malcolm X by the Republican Alex Haley? I think, personally, beautifully written, perhaps a children's book. It's the gateway drug to Malcolm X. I suppose you would you'd give way on that. It is a gateway drug to understanding him. But then you suddenly realize the autobiography of Malcolm X is a pack of lies.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's a great book. I've read it. It was one of my first entries into Malcolm. But the more you understand it, actually, it's a great story, but it is just a story. And actually, it does more harm than good, I think. Because, and the reason why, I don't have any direct evidence that the FBI actually had a hand in editing the book, but I would not be surprised whatsoever. The FBI are on record of murdering people. So it's not a crazy suggestion that maybe they had a hand in the editorial process. Especially because actually I was in an archive and found there are letters between Haley and the FBI, right? So it's not, this is probably true, but who knows, right?
What the case is still ongoing. The three sisters of Malcolm X obviously are still carrying on the case.
Yeah, because I mean, the assassination of Malcolm X, they're trying to sue to get the information because it's widely recognized FBI, CIA, and the New York Police Department had a hand in the murder of Malcolm. But I think when you look at the autobiography, Malcolm starts the Organization of Afro-American Unity in 1964. This is his revolutionary project. This is every speech he gives from 64 onwards is for the OAAU. It is what he's going around the world trying to build. It literally in that book, he mentions it once in passing. At the end, like it's been erased from the book. It's impossible that he didn't talk about this in the book. But what you have in that book is this redemption story of this hustler. Spends far too much time having been a criminal. Then he becomes anti-white. Then he changes that, becomes a Muslim, and he loves. And he's on the road to being the civil rights. It's a nonsense book. It's this whole mythical creation of Malcolm that misses his revolutionary program, and that can't be by accident. So somebody definitely had a hand in curating that image.
Yeah, and obviously they rewrite the histories of all black heroes, notably Nelson Mandela, who is now known just for the peaceful parts of his life. But you have something to say about Mandela in this book. Just repeat what you know about how the Spike Lee film on Malcolm X, why Nelson Mandela pops up there and the controversy over that as regards the spirit of who Malcolm X was versus the reconditioned Mandela of his final years.
Well, this is a perfect example of Mandela. I mean, Mandela being in a movie is spectacularly wrong-headed for many reasons. And what the evidence for this, and I only found this out for writing the book, was if you watch the film, the end of the film, it goes to South Africans saying, "I am Malcolm X." And then Mandela's the one who actually ends the film. And he's supposed to say, he gives us part of a speech, and he's supposed to say, "by any means necessary." But it cuts away from Mandela and goes to Malcolm saying it. And when you watch it, you think that makes sense. But actually, the reason is because Mandela refused to say "by any means necessary," because the Mandela that comes out of prison is a Mandela that admits in his own autobiography to selling out the revolutionary struggle. there is a reason that Mandela is one of the most popular, renowned black, no, not one of the most, probably the most renowned international black figure in the West. It's because he sold out the struggle. Like, Bowker would have lambasted Mandela as being an Uncle Tom without any doubt at all. So the fact that he's in that film and ends that film tells you that the politics of that film is completely and utterly anti the politics of Malcolm X.
What do you think about the fact that time and time again in your new book, you show that Malcolm X, in his writings, precedes other scholars, academics, on so many different topics, analyses of how the neoliberal world works without getting the credit for it? I mean, notably, I suppose, media criticism. And he was very savvy on, he could have been influenced by Gramsci, I don't know. But he was, he really knew about
widely read, Malcolm,
the power of mass media to make the workers of the world misunderstand their situation.
Yeah, if you look at the media, if you look at critical race theory, if you look at neocolonialism, Malcolm really does. I love Malcolm. Malcolm, for me, is the intellectual and activist basis because he's such a clear thinker. Partly this is right, just straight up racism, like, you know, we don't give credit to black thinkers. Also, it's elitism. You know, Malcolm doesn't write a book of his own, has the autobiography, but there's not, these are all, it's oral tradition, it's spoken word rather than being, in a university designation. And so it's just all missed. But the big point is, and the reason why I think someone like Malcolm, someone like the Black Panther Party, is that when you're theorizing blackness, and when you're theorizing revolutionary ideas, when you're theorizing resistance, you can't do that in the ivory tower. If I spend all my time in university with teaching white students and talking to white people, how could I possibly make theory that was useful to black people? It's not going to happen, right? So the best theories that we have are generated by those people in the struggle. And Malcolm's is the perfect example of that, where the ideas are so timeless and he essentially predicts everything with the civil rights movement and the collapse of it, et cetera, et cetera. But he can do that because he's actually in the struggle. He's actually part of the movement rather than just sitting on the sideline in a university.
And remind us, he's not an economist as well. For him to so early on identify the IMF and the World Bank as institutions of destruction.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I say. Malcolm says his alma mater was books. So he read, widely read. And so if you think, I actually went to a socioeconomics conference the other day and presented the book and said, look, Malcolm told you about this, IMF, World Bank, neocolonial economics. Because if you're involved in the struggle for freedom for black people, you have to be thinking about economics, politics, psychology, education, all of these things. And so what I really wanted to do in the book was to make the case as Malcolm as being one of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century. And we'll go back to this conversation about Marx. If I want to understand where we are today, Malcolm's the place to go. It's not Karl Marx. It's Malcolm X. That is how important that intellectual work is.
Yeah, I don't suppose Malcolm X had much to say about unions, though he did have a lot to say about organizations. And he had a lot of trouble trying to organize things, arguably.
But I think Malcolm may not have spoken about unions, but he'll give you the whole critique of the left you can get. My whole critique of the left comes from Malcolm X. I tell you that much. So even if he doesn't particularly speak about it, he's giving you the tools to understand it.
So do you think your book is going to be good enough to dispel all the illusions that have been created by elites, particularly black elites in the United States? Or will we always think of him as a sort of lesser figure than Martin Luther King Jr., who basically thought the same and wanted everyone to be happy and all white and black people to be go merrily into the capitalist future?
Unfortunately, I think I actually have said this before. I think it's, in some ways it would be better that we had totally forgotten about Malcolm than actually the myths that we have now, because they're so powerful and they're so useful. And, you know, America even had a postage stamp with Malcolm X on, which is frankly ludicrous, given everything Malcolm argued for the bankruptness of America. So these myths are really powerful. And I imagine they'll stay strong because those are the ones that we need, right? And the whole point of the book is to say, well, actually, no, look, there's a different way to understand this, a different way to think about this. But are people generally want to understand Malcolm honestly? Do people generally want to understand revolutionary ideas honestly? Probably not, because it indicts all of us. And the biggest thing that's changed, and again, Malcolm told all of us this from 6 years ago, is that now we have token integration. So when Malcolm was speaking about revolution, it was pretty obvious that we weren't going to get a fair shake in America, Jamaica, wherever we were. But the most pernicious thing that's happened, and this also includes the white working class, is we've now been incorporated into the system. So I can be a professor. You can imagine you can be Jay-Z or Beyonce, et cetera, et cetera. And we're trying to, people are migrating here in their millions because they want to be in the house. We're all in the house now. And so the question is, we will only accept Malcolm X when we're ready to say, look, we don't want to be in the house. We want to burn the house down and create something new. But that takes a big leap of faith and imagination that I'm not sure we're quite ready for yet.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but what is critical race theory? Donald Trump is always talking about this and then aligning it with Marxism. And, you know, we've had Angela Davis on this show. I don't think even she was able to define it as in the way that Donald Trump seems to be able to comprehend the whole panoply of what it's all about. Just very, very briefly, what is it that Donald Trump wants to ban from the United States forever? And I think they're going to probably, Western Europe follows in the United States' steps. So what is it?
Well, they just want, I mean, Donald Trump just wants to ban black thought. I mean, it's not everything, the critical race theory just becomes lumped in with everything Marxism. I mean, critical race theory is not Marxism at all. Marxist and critical race theories do not
but
agree.
But no journalist ever anyway. Picks him up on that one. They just say it's
I don't
the
understand,
same thing.
I get called a Marxist all the time, which is heavily ironic because I'm always right against Marxism. But I mean, simply, critical race theory is two ideas. One, racism is a permanent feature of American and Western society. And two, the civil rights movement, therefore, although it looked like we made progress, we actually haven't made any progress. It's just what Derrick Bell calls a particular perverse, it's a regeneration of the problem in a particularly perverse form. And like I said, Malcolm told us in 1963, 64, and 65 that the best we could hope for is total integration and that civil rights would be a dead end. I mean, those are the basic principles of critical race theory, which I think are pretty obvious, I think. But again, can you get the American president to accept that America's racism is in its DNA? Probably not, right?
Professor Gander Andrews, thank you.
You.
That's it for the show. Nobody Can Give You Freedom. The Political Life of Malcolm X is out now. We'll be back on Monday with the final episode of this season. Until then, get in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.